Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramhamsa Parvati Chaitanya Shishi Mat by Grace AC Bhakti Sumishma Prabhupada Ki Jai Bhagavatam Granta Raj Ki Jai. All glorious noble devotees, all glorious noble devotees, all glorious noble devotees, all glorious Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Today we're reading from the glorious Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 7, entitled Lord Shiva Saves the Universe. And that verse is, which verse is that?
That's 42.
That's 42. Okay. We're starting, it's from verse 40, but we'll be repeating verse 42. Actually, verse 40 would have been a long one. Six lines. Please repeat after me. Tata. Karatali.
Karatali.
Kritya. Tata karatali kritya.
Karatali kritya.
Vyapi.
Vyapi.
Hala halam.
Hala halam.
Visham.
Visham.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Abakshayan.
Abakshayan.
Mahadevaha.
Mahadevaha.
Abakshayan Mahadevaha.
Abakshayan Mahadevaha.
Kripaya.
Kripaya.
Bhuta.
Bhuta.
Bhavanaha.
Bhavanaha.
Kripaya Bhuta Bhavanaha.
Kripaya Bhuta Bhavanaha.
Tata kritali kritya.
Tata kritali kritya.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Abakshayan mahadevaha.
Abakshayan mahadevaha.
Kripaya bhuta bhavanaha.
Kripaya bhuta bhavanaha.
Tata karatali kritya.
Tata karatali kritya.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Abakshayan mahadevaha.
Abakshayan mahadeva.
Kripaya bhuta bhavanaha.
Kripaya bhuta bhavanaha.
Others? Others?
Tata kartali kritya.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Abakshayan mahadevaha.
Abakshayan mahadeva.
Kripaya bhuta bhavanaha.
Kripaya bhuta bhavanaha. Takartali kritya.
Takartali kritya.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Vyapi hala halam visham.
Abakshayan mahadeva.
Abakshayan mahadeva.
Kripaya bhuta bhavanaha.
Kripaya bhuta bhavanaha. Tata kartali kritya.
Tata kartali kritya.
Vyapi hala halam visham. Abakshayan mahadeva.
Abakshayan mahadeva.
Kripaya bhuta bhavana.
Kripaya bhuta bhavana.
Mataji.
Tata kartali kritya.
Abakshayan mahadeva.
Kripaya bhuta bhavana.
Please repeat after me. Tata.
Tata.
Thereafter.
Thereafter.
Karatali kritya.
Karatali kritya.
Karatali kritya.
Taking in his hand.
Taking in his hand.
Vyapi.
Widespread.
Halahalam. Called. Halahala. Visham. Poison. Abakshayat. Drank. Mahadevaha. Lord Shiva. Kripaya. Out of compassion. Bhuta Bhavana. For the welfare of all living entities. Transition by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, Lord Shiva, who is dedicated to auspiciousness, benevolent work for humanity, compassionately took the whole quantity of poison in his palm and drank it. So now we'll go back to the previous two verses. 40. Text 40. My dear gentle wife Bhavani, when one performs benevolent activities for others, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, is very pleased. And when the Lord is pleased, I am also pleased, along with all other living creatures. Therefore, let me drink this poison, for all the living entities may thus become happy because of me. So, previously in this chapter, the Prajapatis were, and the Devas were eulogizing Lord Shiva in such a way that they were explaining him what, that one would think that he was actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead because of all his powers. As is described in the Nectar of Devotion, the living entity has 78% of the qualities of the Lord, and Lord Brahma has a greater, same or greater. And then Lord Shiva has great, I don't know exactly where the 84. Exact number. 81%.
81?
Is it? That's the number?
I seem to remember. I thought I remember.
Mataji, you just recently took the Bhakti Shastri test. What's the exact number?
We didn't cover that in the first
time. Okay. Nobody is remembering the exact number.
What is the question?
I'm putting it out there at 84, but check it online maybe.
Anyway, it's greater than 78%, which is for the ordinary Jiva. And so, Lord Shiva, he is in between. He's a very potent. But in this verse, he removes the doubt. You know, that some devotee may have been reading this earlier chapter and wondering, what is happening here? And Lord Shiva is being described as God. But then he removes all doubt and he shows that actually he's also the servant. And that by doing this service, Lord Hari will be pleased. And if Krishna is pleased, then everybody is pleased. Huh? Krishna, samsiddhi, Hari Toshanam. That if you somehow are able to please Hari, then you will achieve all siddhis. Samsiddhi, Hari Toshanam. But if you don't please Hari by your whatever you do, then what is it? Shrama eva hi kevalam. Right? Shrama eva hi kevalam. It's a complete useless waste of time. You may do all your duties perfectly, but if you do not get the taste for hearing of the pastimes of Vishvakshena, Katasuya, then it's all a waste of time. Totally. There was one time when Srila Prabhupada was it was the last days. It was like in April of 1977 in Mumbai. And for some reason, the followers of what's his name now? He's one very popular Mayavadi in India. I can't remember his name now, but he was a disciple of Shivananda Swami. So his followers came to see Srila Prabhupada. And so Srila Prabhupada, he had been told that this person, though he was a complete Mayavadi, he was in the great din, and all kinds, he would say all kinds of nonsensical things like, Krishna means black. Black means nothing. What do you think? Or, if a door is half open, it's half closed. Half is equal to half, therefore open is equal to closed. This is Mayavadi, like he's completely befuddling, you know, all word jugglery like that. So they came to see Srila Prabhupada. And just, you know, just giving some, because they knew Srila Prabhupada was very ill. And they came to give some, you know, some formal greetings and condolences for his health. And they started speaking. And then they made the statement, no one knows the meaning of the Gita. No one understands the Gita. Nobody knows nothing. The Prabhupada immediately, though he was on his deathbed, immediately like he just jumped out of... Don't say nobody knows. You don't know. Don't say nobody knows. They said, well, they try to back out of it, but it was too late now. Don't say nobody knows. You don't know. And he just kept on beating them, kept on hitting them, you know. Don't say nobody knows. You don't know. It's like, it was like he ripped off one of their arms and was beating them with it. Beating them with the wet end. Because he just was ferocious. And finally, as an excuse, they said, well, we have learned it at the feet of our guru. And probably Amita says, Shrama Eva Hi Kevalam. Complete useless waste of time. His whole endeavor is a complete waste of time. And this is Srila Prabhupada. It's in April and May of 1977. He was extremely ill. But same as in a Mumbai pandal, he was very ill. And he was having Bhavananda read from fifth canto 5-5. The one where he's saying, you know, that those who are like camels, dogs, hogs, camels, and asses, that verse like that. So after Bhavananda read it, Prabhupada just grabbed the book. And he just started like, just preaching a storm. And then these people started asking questions, foolish questions. And Prabhupada just blew them, just knocked them over with his answers. He had to be carried up onto the stage, but he got so full of, you know, when he's hearing the Bhagavatam, he just exploded. And he was knocking the people over. So here, we're definitely told that Hari is the Supreme Personality of God. And if you please Hari, when the Lord is pleased, then she says, I'm also pleased. Because if you please the Lord, then all the devas are pleased. There's no necessity for worshipping the devas separately. Sometimes people, they think they have to worship different demigods. But Srila Prabhupada explains that if you just water the root of the tree, then all the leaves are automatically watered. So here it says, Lord Shiva directly confirms that. If the Lord is pleased, then I am pleased. And along with all other creatures are also pleased. So there's no need to do any separate endeavor of worshipping this demigod or that demigod or anything like that. Simply please, you know, if some siddhi haritoshna, that all perfection is there. If we somehow or other please the Lord, Hari. So therefore, let me drink this poison, for all the living entities may thus become happy because of me. So therefore, he wants to get some good credit by pleasing the Lord and therefore benefiting everybody else. He wants other people to be happy because of him. Srila Sukadeva Goswami continued, after informing Bhavani in this way, Lord Shiva began to drink the poison. And Bhavani, who knew perfectly well the capabilities of Lord Shiva, gave him her permission to do so. Now here's an interesting point. That Lord Shiva's wife is giving him permission, as if he needs permission from his wife. And this seems to be a contradictory point. Why does she give him permission? Like, who is in charge, Shiva or her? So this has to be explained. Why is that? Because we see in the third canto, 23rd chapter, verse 3, about how a husband and wife should behave. This is in the Devahuti's Lamentation chapter. So, Maitreya explains to Vidura, O Vidura, Devahuti served her husband with intimacy and great respect, with control of the senses, with love, and with sweet words. So here Srila Prabhupada explains the proper behavior interrelationship between husband and wife. Here two words are very significant. Devahuti served her husband in two ways, Vishrambena and Ghoravena. These are two important processes in serving the husband or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because as Madhvacharya explains, in Srila Prabhupada quotes Madhvacharya in the purport of 7th canto, 11th chapter, verse 29, that the wife should see her husband as good as God, the student should see his guru as good as God, and the servant should see his master as good as God. So that's why it says, in this, serve her husband. So this, these are the two processes for serving the husband or the Supreme Personality of Godhead are equated here. So Vishrambena means with intimacy, and Gauravena means with great reverence. The husband is the very intimate friend, therefore the wife must render service like an intimate friend, and at the same time, she must understand that the husband is superior in position, and thus she must offer him all respect. A man's psychology and woman's psychology are different. As constituted by bodily frame, a man always wants to be superior to his wife, and a wife, as bodily constituted, is naturally inferior to her husband. Thus, the natural instinct is that the husband wants to post himself as superior to the wife, and this must be observed. Even if there is some wrong on the part of the husband, the wife must tolerate it, and thus there will be no misunderstanding between husband and wife. Vishrambena means with intimacy, but it must not be familiarity that breeds contempt. According to the Vedic civilization, a wife cannot call her husband by name. In the present civilization, if you can call it civilization, as one British historian said, tongue-in-cheek, the American peoples are the only ones who had a rise and a fall with no civilization in between. Or as somebody else, another person said that the difference between yogurt and America is that in yogurt there's culture. Because everybody, when you say America, everybody also imitates Canada. That includes Canada, you know. So according to the Vedic civilization, a wife cannot call her husband by name. In the present civilization, the wife calls her husband by name. Or worse, hubby, things like that. Oh, you can see some of the things they call. But in the civilization, she does not. Thus, the inferiority and superiority complexes are recognized. Dhamena cha, a wife has to learn to control herself even if there is a misunderstanding. Soridena vacha madhuraya means always desiring good for the husband and speaking to him in sweet words. A person becomes agitated by so many material contacts in the outside world. Therefore, in his home life, he must be treated by his wife with sweet words. And Srila Prabhupada also made the point that, and it works, that in the evening, the wife should massage the feet of her husband till he falls asleep. That, and even if she's angry with him, because that way he becomes calm and everything is soothed. You know, then there's this peace in the family. So therefore we have to wonder why in this verse Bhavani is giving him permission. She's giving him permission. Why now it appears that the wife is in charge. So the actual reason is that because she's the dependent of the husband, and she's seeing her husband about to drink a lot of poison. So anybody, you know, like if we saw the temple president about to drink a lot of poison, everybody would get a little concerned, right? Like, wait a second, what are you doing? We're all dependent upon you. So the wife is concerned if her husband is going to drink a bunch of poison, and who will be her protector? Or there was one case in the very last days of Srila Prabhupada, like in October or November of 77, when Srila Prabhupada wanted to go on Parikram of Govardhan Hill.
This is October 77.
Yeah, yeah. It was the very last, all of the same. He wanted that Lokanath Swami arrange a bullock cart and they go on Parikram of Govardhan Hill. You know, no springs. Boom, you know, it's like the smooth. They're not exactly silk roads around Govardhan Hill. So everybody, you know, Srila Prabhupada is in charge. But all the disciples were like, you know, freaking out. Like Prabhupada wants to go on. They didn't want him to go. They didn't want him to go because they were afraid. You know, we're all dependent upon Srila Prabhupada, and if he passes away because of that, then who's going to be the shelter? So that's why Bhavani is thinking, you know, who will be my shelter? So, but she knew that he had total that for Lord Shiva to drink. What is this? It's nothing. You know, like I'm like me drinking some water here. Lord Shiva can drink an ocean of poison. So she gave permission. Is that a big deal? But most wives would be, you know, very concerned if their husband would do something like that. You know, the husband, you know, wants to take up skydiving. The wife would get concerned. Would you, if you were married, you would get concerned. Your husband wants to take skydiving up. You know, if at first you don't succeed, then don't take up skydiving. if that's the end of it, you know. And all that works except in skydiving. In such situations, then the permission is given that the dependents, you know, are concerned. And even Srila Prabhupada, he often, because I'm listening to these lectures now from May of 76, he would consult with his disciples. He would consult, what's your opinion? He'd listen and he'd make his decision. Similarly, the wife is considered, she's the Mahamantri. She's the minister of the king, of the husband. She's the advisor of the husband. She gives advice. But like the ministers of the king, they only give advice. They don't make the final decision. The king, he's required. He has to have all so many advisors are there. A king without advisors, he's going to be finished for certain. So then everybody gives their advice. And then the king makes the final decision, whatever he wants. After hearing all the advice, he makes a decision. Because in the end, it's his responsibility. Because if something goes wrong, he gets the blame, not the advisor. The advisor doesn't get the blame. Because I work with the legal office, and Dayaram likes to quote, you know, victory has many fathers, defeat is an orphan. Nobody wants to come and take responsibility of defeat. So he has to make the choice. So I work in the legal office. I help advise him. He knows if I give good advice. But he gets the credit because he gets the blame if we give the wrong advice and he follows it. So the king has to take... The buck stops with him. Everybody may advise, but he has to take the final decision. Somebody, the wife, she's the advisor. She's the well-wisher of her husband. She gives advice. But he has to make the final decision. Because if something goes wrong, he gets the blame. Right? So, certainly the husband, he should hear the advice of his wife. But he has to make the final decision. So, here, Bhavani, she gave her okay. She said it's okay. Because she knows that for Lord Shiva, Bhavani, who knew perfectly well the capabilities of Lord Shiva, gave him her permission to do so. So thereafter, Lord Shiva, who was dedicated to auspicious, benevolent work for humanity, compassionately took the whole quantity of poison in his palm and drank it. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Although there is such a great quantity of poison that is spread all over the universe, Lord Shiva had such great power that he reduced the poison to a small quantity so that he could hold it in his palm. One should not try to imitate Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva can do whatever he likes. But those who try to imitate Lord Shiva by smoking ganja and other poisonous things will certainly be killed because of such activities. So there is... I remember the first one time when I was the head cook in Hyderabad. And so we didn't have a walk-in cooler. We were lucky we had actually a refrigerator. But one of the only temples that had a refrigerator, one of the life members gave us. But every day I had to go shopping, for boga shopping. So in those days, there was nothing, no plastic bags, everything clay cups. So then one day I saw, mountains of these little, chillums. Anybody know what a chillum is?
No.
A chillum is, a chillum is, it's like a pipe, and you stick it in here, and you go like this. And, they use it for smoking hashish. And there was like thousands and thousands of them. Like, I was wondering who, because the Shaivites would buy them and use it for this purpose, smoking ganja. Because you could buy anything in India. Right beside where we were living in Calcutta, there was the opium and ganja shop. And so these people would smoke these activities. They would smoke these things. In fact, Srila Prabhupada was explaining, I just heard it just recently, how his father... See, the reason Srila Prabhupada was not... he didn't want to go see Bhakti Siddhanta. When his friend said, come and see Bhakti Siddhanta, he didn't want to go see him because when he was young, all through his life, Srila Prabhupada's father would invite many sadhus to come to the home. And then he would, for dinner, and then he would ask them, please bless my son, that he will get the mercy of Srimati Radharani. But Srila Prabhupada was not very impressed by these sadhus because they were, they had certain habits. So he was saying how one time he accompanied his father, who was bringing a big bag of ganja to some of these sadhus. He said, my father was very liberal. My father was very liberal. Huge quantities of ganja he would bring. But we learned, that's why he didn't want to go see Bhakti Siddhanta. Because another one of these guys. But it was from Bhakti Siddhanta he learned the importance of purity. No intoxication. What to speak of ganja, not even tea or coffee. No intoxication. Purity is the force. Who is the initiating guru of Bhaktivinoda Thakur? Anybody know? Who's Bhakti Vinod Thakur's Diksha Guru? You won't find him in anywhere. His name is not found in the database. You will not find on the 32 in the disciplic succession. Gorkhashoda Das Babaji comes after Bhakti Vinod Thakur, by the way, not before. it's a Shiksha line. Mostly a Shiksha line, but also Diksha, but Shiksha. The reason his name is not there is because he was addicted to intoxicants. And Bhakti Siddhanta did not like him. So that's why you will not find his name there. By his name, by the way, is Bipin Bihari. Yeah. His name will not, because Bhakti, he was addicted to intoxicants. Tobacco, chewing tobacco and different things like that. So Bhakti Siddhanta... you won't find his name in the database. You will not find his name in any they just recently found Bhakti Siddhanta's diary at the Bhaktivedanta archives in Calcutta, and it mentions that was one of that he disapproved very much of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Diksha Guru because he had his to speak of bags of ganja. He was addicted to tobacco. Maybe some other things too. But that much. So Srila Prabhupada said, from Bhakti Siddhanta, he learned the importance of these clean habits, sattvic, you know, nothing, none of these nonsensical things that these other sadhus were doing. But he says, my father was very liberal. And he also, apparently Bhaktivinoda was somewhat liberal as well. Because that was, in those days, when at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, if you wanted to insult somebody in Bengal, you called him a Vaishnav. That was a great insult. Because after the time of, you're laughing, but just imagine how difficult it was for Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta to revitalize Gaudiya Vaishnava, to bring it to a respectable position. Because shortly, a few generations after the disappearance of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, things became very degraded because of Sahajayism. Sahajayism, all these different apasampradayas. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said about Bhaktisiddhanta that, Lord Chaitanya wanted Bhaktivinoda Thakur to do the work, but he said, I'm too old. You send your secretary. Lord Jagannath, you send your secretary to do this work. So he sent Bhaktisiddhanta. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that Bhaktisiddhanta came with two purposes. His mission that Lord Chaitanya sent him was two purposes: to establish the pure chanting of the holy name, and to do that by reinstituting Daivi Varnashram. The Daivi Varnashram would protect the chanting of the holy name, pure chanting of the holy name, because that's what happened in Bengal and Orisha, that all the Sahaj, they neglected Varnashram, all the Sahaja things, and they became loose connections with women, and Srila Prabhupada says like monkeys with a dozen different wives and things like that. This is the criticism. So that's why Bhaktisiddhanta, he for years, he studied, he collected material on Varnashram. He went to, Lord Chaitanya, there were many sannyasis. He was a sannyasi himself, and there were other sannyasis there, about a dozen or so. But then at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there was no sannyasis. There were no Gaudiya sannyasis. Everybody was a Babaji. But they were all like Paramahamsas, so-called Paramahamsas, where mostly they were all very degraded. That's why it was an insult to call somebody a... They had mastered the art of feigning humility. So humble. It was all a sham. Bhaktisiddhanta, some of his disciples said that if he had just been less caustic and less critical, he would have been the most popular guru of all of North India, practically. But he would not compromise just for popularity. Because there's so many people who are popular, but they were not carrying forth the message of the Lord. What's the good of that? Purity is the force, not numbers. Numbers is not the force. It's purity is the force. As Steve Jobs said, an A team can run circles around a B team or a C team. So, Bhaktisiddhanta, he traveled in South India. He learned from the Sri Sampradaya, about sannyas, how the sannyas diksha. He learned it from the guru in Sri Parambadur, which is the birthplace of Ramanujacharya. He learned about how to do the sannyas diksha, all these different things, because in Sri Sampradaya they're still very strict in following Varnashram for the pleasure of the Lord. That's Daivi Varnashram. The difference between Varnashram and Daivi Varnashram is Arjuna did not want to follow Varnashram because he was concerned about the Purusharthas, Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. So why? He didn't want to follow his Dharma, because if he followed his Dharma, then what would happen? What's the Artha? All his family is killed. And all his family is killed, then what's the Kama? What's the pleasure? So he didn't want to follow his Dharma. So Krishna said, you forget about all that. You just be detached and you do your service in a detached way, that gives you moksha. That's all, you're off the bodily platform, and you do it to please me. That's bhakti. So instead of dharma, artha, kama, moksha, Krishna taught in the Bhagavad Gita, dharma, moksha, bhakti. And it's also, that's why Krishna explains, you know, that sarva dharma paritya, you just do everything for me. And in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, it specifies that all kaitava dharma, all sinful cheating dharma is kicked out. So dharma which, where the person is interested in the artha and the and the artha and the kama, that's cheating religion, that's kicked out. That dharma should not be performed for any artha or kama, but simply as a duty, detachment, for moksha, and that for bhakti, because the moksha, it's brahma-bhuta, prasanatma, nasochati, nakankshati, samasarveshu bhuteshu, madbhaktim labhate param. From the platform of moksha only, you can perform bhakti. So, varna-ashram, Krishna very succinctly explains in the 18th chapter of the Gita, in three verses, and then he says, now I will explain to you how someone can become perfect. Simply you perform your duty to please me. That's Daivi Varnashram. You perform your Varnashram duties to please me. So that's what Bhakti Siddhanta did. He very carefully studied these things, and then he reintroduced the Gaudiya Math. You have Brahmachari Ashram, the Grihasthas, you have Sannyas Ashram. He reintroduced this. That was not found in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. That had been totally erased in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. He reintroduced it to keep it pure. To keep it pure. To stop it from degenerating. And without that Daivi Varna Ashram, then the impurities of the Holy Name take place. That's what happened. As if in defamation, the poison born from the ocean of milk manifested its potency by marking Lord Shiva's neck with a bluish line. That line, however, is now accepted as an ornament of the Lord. So what is one of the names of Lord Shiva? Nilakanta. Right? Nilakanta. His blue neck. He's got a blue neck. It's one of his names. So, we'll stop. Anybody have any questions or comments?
I think, how is it from the hot country of Bhagavatam, how this society is degraded? Like, still, we have like, in our culture, is what they don't call their husband.
Yeah, that's not in the cities, but outside the cities, where the culture is still being maintained to a certain degree.
So-called education is like meant
as. Yeah. They don't what to speak of their husband. They don't call their brother-in-law, the older brother-in-law. They don't call him by his name.
Yeah.
They don't call their father by the name. Out of respect.
What do you call them?
Swami. If you see, you want to learn traditional Veda culture, see some of the old Indian movies. You know, like Vishnu. He doesn't call her, hey Lakshmi. He says, Devi, goddess. And she says, oh Prabhu, or Swami. They're very respectful, very nice. If you read the Ramayana, see, also in the Ramayana, there's one instance when Ram and Sita and Lakshman, they went to Dandakaranya, and Agastya Rishi asks Ram to go to kill all the demons. So as they're going there, Sita, she doesn't think it's a good idea to do it. So she's, but in a very humble and self-deprecating way. She said, "No, I'm an unintelligent woman." And she's very humble and very sweetly. She says to Ramya, like, "I don't think it's a good idea. We don't even know these people. You know, we're going to go over there and kill them all. We don't know. What did they ever do to us?" You know, type of thing. She's speaking, but she's saying it in a very sweet way. And so how did Ram say? Well, how did Ram react? "Oh, you're just a stupid woman." He didn't speak like that. He could understand, but that the way she was speaking, she was very concerned for him. And she was expressing her love. And so he also, because the way she wasn't nagging him or trying to show off, that, you know, try to push him around. She spoke very nicely. And so he responded to her in a equally nice way. A very charming, the whole exchange was very charming. And then he said, "Well, actually, you're wrong." But after appreciating the way she spoke, he said, "But actually, you're wrong." And then he explained why. And then she was convinced. And then they went and, you know, killed a bunch of demons. But they had disagreement. But then when they disagreed, it was a nice, you know, they spoke nicely. So we can learn from that. And, you know, she never addressed him as Ram, except, you know, so there's the whole of Vedic culture is preserved in two major texts, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. That is what is preserved Vedic culture, because that's what everybody reads. Who's reading Vedanta Sutra? Nobody's reading. You know, few people are reading Vedanta Sutra with the Upanishads. Yeah, some people are reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, but everybody reads, everybody knows the Ramayana and Mahabharata. They know that. Because that preserves the whole culture, the whole civilization has been preserved because of those two texts. When they made a television series, Ramayana, the whole country just came to a stop. Nothing would work. Everybody just sat down and watched Ramayana, or they watched the Mahabharata. Whenever it came on, they were just completely fixated. Because it's, you know, the nature. Like the whole touching scene between... Because all of relationships are covered. How does a son deal with his father? How do younger brothers deal with older brothers? How does a husband deal with his wife? How does a wife deal with her husband? How does a son deal with his... other mothers, because his father had three main wives and 300 other wives. So how do you deal with the other wives? He treated them equally, with the same respect. And all the different relationships of respect. So if we follow that example, then civilization and society, the whole of like the Manu Samhita, the whole of Manu Samhita is just how to respect somebody else. How to give respect to people. If we don't respect anybody, if we don't know how to properly behave, then how will we ever get into Vaikuntha? How will we ever get into Goloka Vrindavan? That's how Krishna deals with people. He's very respectful. You know? There's a very nice lecture series on the Pancharatra by Bhakti Vidyapurna Swami. You can get it, download it. It's about, I think it's about 40 seminars. And he makes a point that why do we knock on the door when we go into the pujari room? You go into the pujari, we knock on the door, right? Why should we knock on the door? Krishna's in your heart. He knows you're there. He's in a Paramatma. In fact, he's in your knuckles. And he's in the door. He's in the door. All energy is made from Krishna. So why should we knock? He already knows we're there. Because Krishna's a person. If Krishna came to your house, he'd knock on your door. Because he's a gentleman. He's humble. He doesn't just barge in. He'd knock on your door. So there's a whole gentle behavior which is found in Krishna's domain. And unless we learn how to behave that way, how will we get in? We just can't, you know, Say we want to go. We can't be date crashers, party crashers. We have to be qualified by our behavior. So the whole thing is training. The whole Pancharatrik system is training how to deal with the Lord and His servants. The Hoyan. How to brush our teeth, how to clean our, clean our bodies. That's all part of Pancharatra. The whole method, the whole science of how to worship the Lord. That's so that we'll have practice, and when we go there, we'll know how to deal with Krishna and His associates. But that culture is still, if you go to big cities in India, it's very sad, actually. Remember when we were first going to, when we were first living in India, because we were smaller cities, when we had to go back to the West, what we would do to, we would go to, say, Mumbai or Delhi, and that would be like the entry, getting us ready to go back to the West, because these are a lot more westernized cities, like the airlock in a spaceship, getting ready to go outside. But it's become very westernized. But still, amazingly enough, even in a city like Bangalore, they call it Bargalore because there's so many bars and pubs there. But like our next door neighbor, there's a building you can see. There's the grandfather, the father teaching his son how to do his Sandhya Vandanam. And I was amazed. I was shocked. In Malleshwaram, which is like the next part of the city, I live in Seshadripuram in Malleshwaram. Those are like the older parts of Bangalore. A lot more Brahmins live there. There's an apartment building which is a Gurukul. I was like really like, I said, I wanted to take Sanskrit lessons. Then was at the Gurukul, and I went to the apartment. Where's the Gurukul? Over there. So there's a whole flat which is actually a Gurukul. It's all these young boys all shaved up. They're teaching. It's a Veda Pathshala where they're teaching them the Vedas. I was like, wow, this is pretty amazing. In the middle of the big dirty city, they still have this going on. They're really tightly holding on to their tradition, which is pretty amazing considering what the onslaught. But if you go to other, you go out of the cities, you go into the villages, and India is mostly like what, 700,000 villages. And it's all the big cities, like Calcutta, Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, Hyderabad, Bangalore. And after that, people have to live somewhere. There's all the other small cities. So significantly more traditional, and it's true. If you will see everything in Prabhupada's books in India, even today, you will see that. Maybe not all in the same place, maybe not all at once, but at everywhere. The only thing you won't see is women carried in palanquins. They just don't do that anymore. Nobody's carried in palanquins anymore. But his Prabhupada's father, his Prabhupada's mother used to be carried in a palanquin. But nobody does that because they don't have palanquins anymore. But everything else which Srila Prabhupada mentions can still be found. There's still people who are very strictly following Veda culture.
We had cycle, bicycle.
Yeah.
But there wasn't like car or motorcycle. we had like
bullock cart. Yeah, that was much better.
Yeah. We do like whatever travel or we used to do that.
Yeah, nobody.
Now there is now no more bullock cart. It's available.
Yeah, now it's petrol. Now you have to go by petrol. Bullock carts are better. The bullock if he needs more fuel, just go to the side of the road, eat some grass.
No, even bullock cart, you can defend the road. You can sleep even. This cow will go automatically. He knows the road,
yeah.
And he'll go automatically slowly.
Yeah, you don't even
have
to.
You can
see?
Sleep.
Automatic pilot.
You can sleep. If he knows the road. Not for the first time is different, but if you know the roads, you'll come automatically to your home. So,
Right, and then when the bullock cart, when he passes through, people, they would rush. I would see that if a cow was walking in the street and he passed done, people would rush, grab it, they'd fight practically. Who's going to get it first? Huh. They'd take it, they'd make it fatty. Anything vertical, they'd put it on there.
Yeah.
Vertical, dry it out, use it for cooking. Everything for free. The grass, it was the fuel for the bullock cart. Nobody ever fought wars for, the two major wars that were fought were for oil. The last, they come the Gulf War, but I call them the oil wars. The first and second oil war. How can our oil be under your soil? Nobody went in Uganda where 800,000 people were murdered. Nobody went there. They went to Kuwait when Iraq invaded Kuwait. They came to the rescue of Kuwait. At the same time, just next door in Uganda, about 500 miles away, there was a huge slaughter. Nobody cared. Nobody went there. Because there's no oil over there. No oil. No geopolitical interest there. So nobody ever got killed for cow dung. Like that. But these traditions are still going on, despite the... in fact, that's what Srila Prabhupada wanted. When I first went to India, I was just about to leave. Practically the day before I was supposed to leave, I was supposed to come back to Canada, go to Ottawa. I was with the Ottawa Temple. And Sridhar Swami, he grabbed me. He said, you're a Canadian citizen, you're a British Commonwealth citizen. At that time, we didn't need a visa to go to India. No visa required for people from British Commonwealth. Canadian. I didn't even have to I didn't have to prove that I was Canadian. I just said I was Canadian, and they thought, that's good enough. They didn't want to see my passport, just that I said I was. So he said, Srila Prabhupada wants his disciples to live in India at least for 1 year. Because that way you can learn Veda culture by osmosis. He said that just like an elephant is worth 1 lakh rupees dead or alive. Because even when it's dead, the ivory is worth money. So even though Veda culture is dead, there's still the remnants are there, you can learn from it, you can absorb it. Because no matter where you go, there are still people who are following the culture. So that he wanted all of us to spend at least 1 year there and imbibe that culture and learn it. And not just staying in places like Mayapur or Vrindavan, which is the Angreji Mandir. Because if you just go to India and stay with a bunch of Americans or Canadians, you're not going to, you're going to just be like India, like my grandmother. Came from Italy, lived in the Italian enclave, and after 65 years living in Canada, didn't know how to speak English.
You see, in Vrindavan, people don't know ISKCON temple.
Angreji Mandir. But the thing, if you go from Canada and you go to India and you just hang out with the Canadians or the Americans, what are you going to learn? You have to. But not just that you hang out with any Indian. You have to know we were cultured people. India is the land of Ram and Krishna, but it's also the land of Ravana and Kamsa, and never forget that. Never forget that. But you will not meet any nicer people. And there are still very many people who are very cultured and who are following the traditional Veda culture. And those people you can learn. I learned so much philosophy just by riding in the train. Because now it's cheaper to go by airplane. But then you had to go by train. And trains would be from Calcutta to Chennai would be like a 2-day train ride. And you're stuck in the same compartment with somebody. So unlike your ordinary Canadian, if you were stuck in a train with a Canadian or an American for 2 days, what would you be talking about? These people know the Gita. They know Shastra. So you have to know your philosophy. Otherwise, you learn philosophy just because you have to be able to defend yourself. I was taking a train from Baroda to Calcutta. And so I was, you know, the train was leaving at noon, so I pulled out my gindi and I was doing Achwin and I started doing my Sandhya Vandana. And there was this one man, he was like, you know, looking at me. And then after a few hours, he came and sat down beside me and he introduced himself. He was a wing commander in the Air Force. He says, I'm such and such Mishra. So that means he's a Brahmin from North India. He says, I've been watching you for several hours. He says, everything you're doing, I should be doing. I should be doing everything you're doing. Yeah. He was so... you know, I mean, you, especially as a Westerner, if you go to India, they may not say anything, but they're watching everything, every move that you make. So for God's sake, don't... If you're a male, wear dhoti. Don't wear yogi... Don't wear pants. And if you're a woman, wear nice saris. Dress nicely. They're watching every move you make. Every little move you make. And so it's easy to preach in India. All you have to do is dress nicely and smile if you're from the West. It's a fact. The easiest preaching in the world. I was getting out of the... we were standing outside the Delhi temple waiting to go to see an Ayurvedic doctor. This before Ram Navami in 2008. So we were standing and this bus came in to the Delhi temple. And all, and from, I don't know where they're from, maybe some village, and all these people got out, you know. Just as we were standing, there's one young lady, she walked up the steps beside us, and she was wearing such tight jeans, you could, and it was a little bit low cut, you could see the, you know, the cleft in the behind. And they were really tight. And so they came out, and they were looking at us, and they were looking at her. And they were like, you know, then they came over to ours, and they were going, like this. They got their cameras taking photographs of us. But then what was amazing is about 10 minutes later, that girl came out and she came up to my wife and she started complimenting my wife. How nicely she was dressed. You know, how beautiful she was, like that. You know, so they very much, because they're still, even though the British left 70 years ago, 60 years ago, they still have a colonial mindset that they imitate anything from the West. So it's so important that Western devotees go there, that they dress nicely as devotees. They dress nice. I buy my wife the nicest saris. I always get her, you know, all jewelry. Just to go outside, you should be dressed nicely. And so many times women have stopped her in the middle of the street just to say how nice she looks and how they want to, you know. It's very powerful preaching that way. Very powerful. Because they're imitating people in the West. So that's why Srila Prabhupada wanted Bhaktisiddhanta sent. He used an ancient military tactic. Like in the Second Punic War, the Romans defeated Hannibal. Hannibal was ravaging Italy. They couldn't defeat him because he was such a... one of the most... the best generals in all history. So they couldn't defeat him in direct battle. So they were sort of like just keeping him at bay. And so then they sent Scipio to Africa. And that forced Hannibal to leave Italy. So Bhaktisiddhanta, that's why Bhaktisiddhanta's strategy was that because Indians were so allured and enamored by Western, the glitter of Western culture because of the British dominating, so he wanted to send preachers to the West. As he said, Western civilization must be crushed. Not like by Al-Qaeda method, but by higher ideals. Better ideas. As was just somebody wrote in an article recently, how talking about the Hare Krishna movement, how we haven't got the numbers like the Muslims or the Christians, but our ideas are all pervasive, have become all pervasive in North America. When we were growing up, when I was growing up, nobody ever heard of reincarnation. Did you hear about reincarnation when you were a kid in school?
No.
Vegetarianism, karma, the word karma, nobody, these are unknown terms, concepts, specifically reincarnation. Now, everybody's, you know, accepts this concept, reincarnation. Or that movie, there's so many movies been made since the late 90s to now, about this concept that this world is an illusion. Like, almost everybody has seen the movie The Matrix.
That's why.
It's a virtual reality. Where did they get that idea from? Because actually the directors of that movie read the Bhagavad Gita. It's a known fact. They read the Bhagavad Gita. They're from Chicago. They read the Gita. You maybe distributed that book to them.
Probably.
Their parents were atheists. Their parents were atheists, the Warkarskis. Their parents were atheists, and so as good, rebellious children, they read the Bhagavad Gita. And they read about religion because their parents were atheists. So the ideas of in these books, so that's why Bhaktisiddhanta wanted to send his disciples there. And so Srila Prabhupada, he was being very unsuccessful in India preaching by himself. Nobody would become a devotee.
Yeah.
So then he went to the West to get his white elephants. Dancing white elephants. And they came when they, you know, when he brought them over there. Then everybody was then he had so much attention. Because you see now that the Western people are adopting Indian culture. That had a very big impression then. So the point is that ISKCON is meant to revive Vedic culture. But there's a problem. Is that while a certain group of Western devotees, they want to very much imbibe Srila Prabhupada's teaching, there's others who, you know, like my viewpoint is, well, if this is what the culture is, we should dive into it. We should get into it, right? That's the way I look at it. If this is what Srila Prabhupada is teaching. He wanted us to stay in India to learn this culture. We should learn this culture. And there's others who sort of like a spray-on version. We'll keep everything Western. We spray some Krishna consciousness on it. And they still maintain a lot of Western... they still have a lot of attachment to Western culture. And they're affected by... I mean, the litmus test is something like, say, feminism. So they want to introduce that into India, which is would be destructive to Vedic culture. Sort of like if you had you're a patient in the IV in the ICU, and there's an IV being trying to revitalize you, and then somebody's injecting poison into the IV. How is that going to help? So there's that. So because of the there's one incident. It was in December 1976, because I know the devotee, he was there. It's recorded on the... it happened in Hyderabad at the farm. It was a complete fiasco program that Srila Prabhupada came to the farm, and they were distributing food to the local population. So, this time Srila Prabhupada asked for a sample. So it's mass food distribution. Normally Prabhupada didn't ask for a sample. This time he asked Harishori, go get me a sample. So Harishori went and got a sample, and he saw a queue of people, and they were lining up to get prasad, so-called prasadam, and the guy would throw the stuff on them, and then they'd look at it and they'd throw it on the ground. And then these starving, if you've been to India, you see like these street dogs. You've been to India, right? You see, there's these street dogs starving, and they come and smell it, and then they just turned away.
Huh.
So Prabhupada was furious. So Harishori came and told me he was furious. And, that they had, prasadam should be good enough for God. Not that the dog will refuse it, the starving dog. So there was a whole fiasco there. And so the next morning, when they came into the temple, it was a mess. And the stuff was on the floor, and probably there's a mess here. And so one of my godbrothers, he got on his knees, and he had to get a little knife out, and he was like scraping the floor, which is not how you clean a floor. So the prophet said, what are you doing? He says, I'm cleaning the floor. So the prophet says, take that knife and cut your throat. A order from the guru which should not be followed. A at least, but he was like very upset. Take that knife and cut yourself. The devotee personally told me, and several other devotees were there, they also told me, take that knife and cut your throat. Then he said to my godbrother, Ram Shraddha, who is a Palgat Ayra from Hyderabad, the Brahmins, Palgat Ayras. He said, why are you late? He says, your parents trained you better than this. Don't learn the bad habits of the Westerners. Don't learn the bad habits of the Westerners. And then, after telling me that story, Ram Shraddha says, and since I've joined ISKCON, I've learned so many bad habits. That's not what ISKCON, you know, so we have to be very careful. That's become a problem now in India. That imitating the West, so ISKCON is supposed to help revive the culture, we have to be careful that that the enthusiasm for adopting, reviving their culture is there, but not to learn the bad habits. You know, as I said, I think I mentioned earlier, Prabhupada had a much higher standard from his Indian disciples than from his, you know, because they had better training right from birth. Right from birth. Well, he didn't have that expectation from his Western disciples because they didn't have their malechas and yavanas.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, because he didn't teach it, didn't mean you shouldn't teach. You shouldn't learn it. It may be because you weren't ready to learn it. Just, you know, you have a kindergarten student. You have a, you know, somebody in university. How much can you learn? They didn't learn it. Didn't mean that you shouldn't learn it. Because there were so many examples. Like Harishai was saying one time, you know, he had a clean tray in one hand. And he had a plate that had been eaten on in one hand, and he was carrying it. Prabhupada, stop that. What are you doing? You don't. Now they're both contaminated. Because you're carrying a dirty plate in one hand and a clean plate in the other. Now they're both contaminated. You're malecha, he said. Just a malecha. He was just frustrated. They're malechas. Don't know cleanliness. So Srila Prabhupada could only teach his Western disciples so much. That's why he wanted us to spend time in India to learn things. But of course, that's a tricky part though, is you have to know after reading all of Srila Prabhupada's books, that becomes the measuring stick, because lots of nonsense goes on in India as well. Not that everything is because it's in India. I know God brother people who specifically I know some astrologers. Well, Indian astrologers, they worship Ganesh and they worship demigod, so that's what they started doing. That's nonsense. That's not Vaishnava. A lot of nonsense also goes on in India. I said, it's the land of Ram and Krishna. Also Ravana and Kamsa. Never forget it. Never forget that. If you forget that at your own peril. At your physical and spiritual peril. Yeah. So, just because they said Srila Prabhupada didn't teach it, does that mean it's not important, or that they weren't ready to hear it? They weren't ready to learn it at that time. Like in the beginning, Srila Prabhupada was very much involved in the marriages of his disciples because there was nobody else. He performed marriage sacrifices. He arranged the marriages. And sannyasis actually are not supposed to perform fire sacrifices or to speak of marriage sacrifices. But since he was the only one there, he did that. He said that his godbrothers joked about that Prabhupada was the marrying sannyasi. But so at first he got very involved, but then he saw, because he expected, like this, like in his case, marriage is a duty. He didn't like his wife. Not that after some time he didn't like her. He didn't like her from the very beginning. He didn't want to marry her. He wanted to marry another girl. In fact, he wanted to have a second wife. But his father discouraged him. No, that's okay. You'll be detached. Because he had so much faith in his father, he did what his father said. He had so much faith in his father because his father was a pure devotee. So he got married to a girl he didn't even like. But never a question of divorce. That was an alien concept. So he accepted that because that's culture. That you maintain your spouse, you're doing it to please Krishna. Not to please her. You're doing it to please Krishna. If you're doing it to please her, who knows what bad treatment she might get. But to please Krishna, then the best treatment will. He'll do the very best. Because you're doing it to please Krishna. It's like Lord Shiva. Huh? What is he? He's going to drink the poison because Krishna will be pleased. So he expected that also that his disciples, but that's not what happened. That's not. They did so much hanky-panky, musical beds, divorce, this, that, and the other thing. And he said, after some time, he washed his hands. You, at your own risk, he became disgusted. I collected a whole series of letters about Prabhupada and marriage from the beginning until the point he just was completely disgusted. At your own risk, I have nothing to do with it. Because they were yavanas. They are. We are yavanas. No concept that you do this as a duty to please Krishna, which is how he was trained. That was the culture. And still outside the cities. And now there's divorce in India, and more and more people are getting. But that's mostly in the cities, not outside the cities. It's a cultural war. But if we want to go back to Godhead, if we want to become in Krishna's culture, in Krishna's society, then we have to approach Krishna on his terms. That's how he behaves. This is his culture. He's not a yavana. Krishna's not a yavana. He is a follower of the Veda culture. Like the example in the Ramayana, Bharata and Lakshman and Shatrughna, they treated Lord Ram as good as if he was God. Of course, he was God, but they also were God. But they treated him as good as if he was their father. They get all respect as the older brother. So how much older was he? He was one day older than Bharat. And 2 days older than Shatrughna and Lakshman. They were born because all the wives got the Payasam on the same day. Lord Ram was born on Punarvasu, fourth pada. Bharata was born in Pushyami. And then Shatrughna and Lakshman were born in Aslesha, one after the other, each nakshatra. One day after the other. But one day separation, Bharat treated him as good as God, as good as his own father. Completely obeyed him. Same with Lakshman. That was the respect that they gave. Right? Is that the older brother has given you so much respect? Or older sister? Or mother? There's one case in like this. Now there's the whole, here it shows a west east west dichotomy, but this concept of calling a woman, she should be called mother or Prabhu. In the West, they don't think mother is a very is not a high enough term, but in India, to call a woman mother is a very 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 highly respectable term. There was one case of one boy in college. They were hazing him. They were giving him a hard time, and part of it was that they got him to insult his mother. They forced him to insult his mother, and he went home and committed suicide because he insulted his mother. Or there was he just walked out of the Sri Rangam temple, and there was this old man on his knees, and he was just vomiting. And obviously his parents were already dead, but he was calling for Amma and Appa. to come and help him. Amma, anybody, any woman, Amma is mother, Appa is father. He's calling mother, father, come help me. Any woman is considered mother. It's a completely different culture, not just theoretical. And we have to give up our own conditioning, material conditioning that we've gotten from living in the West. Anything else?
Thank you so much.
Huh?
Thank you so much.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Thank you for all the stories.